Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A record 235 million people will need humanitarian assistance and protection next year, a near 40% increase on 2020, which is almost entirely from COVID-19, the UN's emergency relief chief said on Tuesday. Mark Lowcock said that the global health crisis had impacted dramatically on people already reeling from conflict, record levels of displacement and climate change shocks. He said that multiple famines were also looming and that the UN and partners were overwhelmed.
The picture we are presenting is the bleakest and darkest perspective on humanitarian need in the period ahead that we have ever set out, I think. And that is a reflection of the fact that the COVID pandemic has wreaked carnage across the whole of the most fragile and vulnerable countries on the planet.
This year's Global Humanitarian Overview sets out plans to reach 160 million of the most vulnerable people in 56 countries. Aid funding will be used next year to stave off famine, fight poverty, and keep children vaccinated and in school, Mr. Lowcock explained. And cash will also be used from the UN's Central Emergency Relief Fund to tackle rising violence against women and girls linked to the pandemic. 2 in 3 school-aged children, 1.3 billion in all, do not have internet access at home, and it's preventing them from learning vital skills they need to thrive, the UN said on Tuesday. The findings, uncovered in a joint report by UN Children's Fund UNICEF and the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, also highlighted a similar lack of access for 15 to 24-year-olds, with more than 6 in 10 of them lacking web access. The massive number is more than a digital gap, it's a digital canyon, said Henrietta Faure, UNICEF executive director. She said that this lack of connectivity doesn't just limit children and young people's ability to connect online, it isolates them from work and prevents them from competing in the modern economy. Ms. Faure noted that school closures linked to the coronavirus crisis had made things worse for millions and were effectively costing the next generation their futures. Globally, 58% of school-aged children from wealthiest households have an internet connection at home, compared with only 16% from the poorest, the UN report found. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has appealed to Ethiopia for access to thousands of refugees whose supplies have been cut by the month-long conflict in the north of the country, saying its concerns are growing by the hour. Spokesperson Babar Balogh told journalists in Geneva that urgent access was needed to reach around 96,000 Eritrean nationals sheltering in Tigray region, as they will have run out of food. The UN agency also cited unconfirmed reports of attacks, abductions and forced recruitment at the refugee camps housing the Eritreans, although it said that difficulties in communications and security meant that it was not possible to verify conditions in these settlements. The plea for access follows the launch of a $147 million appeal by UNHCR to meet the needs of more than 40,000 Ethiopians who fled fighting in Tigray and sought shelter in neighboring Sudan. By April, numbers are expected to reach 100,000. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Many of us have made hard changes to save lives from COVID-19. Has that opened doors for the other big emergency, climate action? Australian author Tim Flannery is right on that with his new book, The Climate Cure, Solving the Climate Emergency in the Era of COVID-19. Tim is a zoologist, he's a teacher, he has advised governments, he's the author of more than a dozen books, including the international bestseller, The Weathermakers. From Sydney, Tim Flannery, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Could you just start by telling us about those severe lockdown measures in Melbourne and what the results have been so far?
Yeah, sure. Look, Australia responded early and pretty ferociously, really, to the threat of the COVID pandemic. We shut down all flights to China in February, which was well ahead of many other nations. And the Australian Prime Minister declared a COVID pandemic 12 days before the World Health Organization did it. So we were pretty on the ball. And then in Melbourne, as things started to get out of control in that city, I would say that one of the world's strictest lockdowns unfolded. And my family were involved in that, so I know it pretty intimately. But for about 4 months, the city was really severely locked down. And as a result of that, we haven't had a COVID case now in Australia for some time.
From here in North America or in Europe, that sounds like a miracle, but it is tough. And so many stayed home during the pandemic in many countries that the World Meteorological Organization just reported a reduction in our increase of emissions. We're still emitting, but perhaps not quite as much. But they call it a blip. What do you see in the COVID-19 battle that could push us towards climate action, Tim?
Well, look, Alex, it really is true that the what we've seen, the decrease in the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has been a blip. It's like a quarter of a percent at best, thereabouts. What gives me hope is the way that governments acted, at least here in Australia, to bring the pandemic under control. And what they did was they took three steps that were pretty simple. You know, the first one was this emergency measure to stop the spread. So that was the lockdown, and it was spectacularly effective. In terms of climate and dealing with the climate crisis, the equivalent is really to start cutting your emissions. You know, we know we need to cut our emissions by 8% a year, year on year. And with the sort of focus that the Australian government brought to stopping the pandemic spread, that would be an easy reach for a place like Australia. Cutting 8% a year, we could easily do that. And we're still burning a lot of coal for electricity, so that's where you'd start. The second thing that the government did was make sure we had enough capacity in our health services, in our emergency response, to deal with all of the casualties that were coming down the pipeline. And, you know, in climate terms, we've got to do that as well. And, you know, we've got to make sure that the casualties, everything from Australia's Great Barrier Reef through to people suffering from heat stress or those whose homes are disappearing because of melting permafrost, we need to make sure we've got the capacity to deal with all of those casualties and make sure that we can move together as a community to minimise that damage. And that takes a strong government focus, you know, on this issue and on it as an emergency. And the third thing we have to do is really start searching for a vaccine. You know, I remember when the COVID pandemic first broke, there was a lot of people saying, well, we may not get a vaccine. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to take a long time. And there's a great deal of uncertainty there. Well, in terms of climate, the search for the vaccine is really a search for a healed planet. You know, we've got to stop knocking down our forests. We have to start respecting our oceans. We have to start letting the organs of planet Earth sequester CO2 at scale again, you know. And that's what kept the balance of our planet over time, is life itself. So they're the three steps that I see that are critically important in terms of getting on top of this climate emergency.
You know, I've been doing this for 14, actually 15 years now, and I noticed that in Europe and North America, we now see healthcare workers are close to burnout, and, you know, they see unmasked citizens unwilling to give up even the simplest customs of life. Thanksgiving went ahead for millions of people in the United States. So medical professionals, they don't have any choice but to fight on until they burn out, they succumb, or improbably stem the tide of disease. After your long fight to bring climate action to Australia and the world, Tim, do you sometimes feel the same?
I do, Alex. I'm pretty stubborn. I guess that's one of my more outstanding characteristics. So for me to give up the fight is not thinkable. I prefer to push on to exhaustion, you know, because it's so important for me and my children. So we just have to push on. And you know, I hear what you're saying about that libertarian view that says I can just do whatever I want in the face of a pandemic. Well, that's writing people's death certificates to do that. You know, we know there's a better way. We've done it here in Australia. Other nations such as South Korea and Japan have done it. We know we can do better than this. And I think it is a matter of pushing on through that exhaustion till you get that outcome.
And I know that over the years, Australian governments made a lot of noise about climate change. Way back in 2008, I reported, hopefully, on the Garneau Report. So why, in a land of bright sunshine, is your country still dependent on coal for electricity?
Well, this is the great paradox, you know, it's a double paradox for me now because I've seen the government act so promptly and so effectively on an emergency, on the COVID emergency. You know, so if they could do that, why can't they do it on climate? Well, you know, the reality is for Australia that we are the world's largest exporter of coal and natural gas. So, you know, we're stuck in this trap where a resource economy, strong, heavily dependent upon those resources, and yet we're also exquisitely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change itself, as the summer bushfires showed. So we are working our way through this as a nation, people are gradually aligning to a particular view, I think, which is that, yes, we'll be a resource economy, but we need to be mining our sunlight and our wind and our lithium rather than our coal, oil and gas. So there is a shift, but boy, it's taken far longer than it should have.
I'm a little puzzled when you say that Australia is the world's largest exporter of natural gas, because when I look it up in various sources, they all put Russia at about four times Australia's level of gas exports, and there are others ahead, including Canada, exporting gas. So how do you arrive at that?
Oh, look, it actually may be maritime, the shipped gas overseas. I think a lot of countries pump a lot through pipelines, but in terms of actually shipped gas, I think Australia is the largest exporter. I'd have to look at those figures for Russia and so forth again, but certainly the Australian government's constantly touting the idea that we're the world's largest exporter of gas. And, of course, that gas that's sent by ship it's kind of damaging, because you have to use 20% of the gas that you extract from the earth to compress the remaining gas to get it into those shipping vessels. So it's quite emissions intensive.
And you have an energy minister promoting even more gas as some sort of clean engine of recovery from these lockdown economic losses. Are we buying into the idea that fossil fuel companies could be saviors from the COVID crash?
Well, the federal minister is certainly touting that line. They've lost the battle with coal now, and they're silent on that. But they are talking about gas as the salvation for our economy. And increasingly, it's that kind of view has been shown to be nonsensical. When you look at the states in Australia that are most advanced in terms of the energy transition, places like South Australia, we see that they're actually burning less gas now than they were in the past. They're using some for electricity generation, but not as much as certainly the federal minister would argue that they will in future. So, I don't think gas is a transition fuel anymore. Renewables have now become so cheap, and battery storage and some hydro storage, pumped hydro, have become so affordable that gas has kind of been dealt out of it. And yet we're still seeing the federal government insisting that gas has a role. And I think that's because, companies in Australia have spent something like $80 billion building, I think it's seven huge gas trains here in the nation to export gas. And that money, I guess, is under a risk of being lost unless they can somehow make their profits.
And in your new book, The Climate Cure, you seem to blame skillful oil, gas and coal lobbies for continuing bad public choices. But aren't we all responsible? I mean, I know people who buy very expensive cars or trucks and don't use public transit. They don't like electric vehicles. And people will fly a whole wedding party to Fiji just for fun. We're easily deceived when it fits our interests too, don't you think?
I do. Look, and it's true that we all have to do something about this and change our lifestyles. But it's government policy that makes that easier or harder. So, if you had some sort of carbon taxes, I know you're having in BC, you can hasten the transition and make it easier for people to make the right choices. In Australia, we're a long way from that. Government policy is such that, you pay for your electricity bill, but you can't really tell how much of that's black power or green power for most people. So it's hastening the energy transition, in Australia's case, say, away from coal and towards clean energy, that makes it that much easier for people to make the right choices.
During reporting on the bushfires last year, we saw way too much footage of dead and dying animals. As a zoologist, Tim, can we bring our beloved species along with us into this hot, unstable world we're making?
Wow, well, that is a great question that we're still investigating here in Australia. Those bushfires were truly exceptional. Up until that point, I think the largest area of temperate broadleaf forest burnt in any single year in Australia was around 2%, which is bad enough. But last summer, those fires burned 21% of our temperate broadleaf forests. So you can imagine a tenfold increase in the area burned. How much more difficult it is for species to recolonise those new areas just because they have to move over much larger areas. And, of course, the refuges are relatively smaller. So we're still trying to work out what the full impacts of those fires have been on our biodiversity. But I'm really concerned over the longer term. I mean, if you assume that we're going to get fires like this again, and the science is pretty clear that we will, then I'm really worried about species like the koala, in particularly in eastern Australia, where those, you know, the populations seem to be in decline.
Last January, I interviewed Professor Tim Lenton from the UK. He led a team of top world scientists warning about cascading tipping points, and it may be already too late for some. What is at stake here, Tim? We're not fooling around. What's at stake?
Well, look, Tim's work and that team's work has been a total eye-opener for the world, because what he has shown is that we are rapidly approaching some of the Earth's tipping points. So if, for example, we get to a tipping point with permafrost melt, we will see such vast volumes of methane and CO2 emitted into the atmosphere that it will dwarf any human efforts to kind of pull back from the brink, if you want, of this rapidly warming world. The same is true for Arctic ice and for the Western Antarctic ice sheet and for the Amazon rainforest and so forth. So, you know, Tim is really, his work is a last appeal to us to say, cut emissions now before we commit ourselves irrevocably to a very hostile future.
Do you think it's possible we have some sort of group mind which includes suicidal urges? And if that was true, can we go anywhere without dealing with that?
My general experience in Australia, at least, and in Canada, you know, when I've gone around and spoken to people, individual people, most people are responsible and reasonable. But when they get stirred up with an ideology and people conflate ideas of, say, climate change with particular ideological perspectives or moral stances in completely unrelated areas that people sign on to, then you start getting bad decision-making. But I don't think we do have a common mind with a kind of suicidal urge. I think if we can just take the heat out of this issue, look at it objectively, take the ideology away, people will start making the right decisions.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Tim Flannery, and we're talking about the climate cure, solving the climate emergency in the era of COVID-19. Is there a climate equivalent of a vaccine?
Yeah, look, there really is, and you can see how it would work. I mean, David Attenborough's latest documentary laid out the case very well, you know. He said that we have to rewild our planet. We have to restore the planet's capacity to heal itself. And this is absolutely central. You know, if we look at what we're doing with the world, we're still clearing forests instead of regrowing them. We need to start regrowing them at a massive scale because trees draw CO2 out of the atmosphere, you know. We need to start growing seaweed, I believe, in the oceans to hasten that uptake of CO2, because seaweed draws CO2 out of the atmosphere at very rapidly and potentially at scale. We also need to start using things like silicate rocks. You know, there's a certain class of rocks that as they decompose, they draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. It's a natural process. But we can mine those rocks using clean energy, grind them up, and distribute them on beaches and so forth where they'll absorb large volumes of CO2. In fact, one recent study showed that if we just used the rock grindings we currently create through quarrying and so forth and put them in the right spot, we'd be drawing 2 gigatons of CO2 out of the air per year. So there's a whole lot of things we can do in terms of a vaccine. And the vaccine takes the CO2 out of the air, it removes the problem, slows the warming, and gets us back into a stable and sustainable state.
So tell us about the start of a transition to safe energy in South Australia.
Well, I lived through that, Alex. I moved to South Australia in 1999. There was a Conservative government in place. There wasn't a single wind farm in the state. There was very, very few solar panels. But in 2001, a Labor government was elected. I was asked to chair a couple of committees for them and saw the transition close up. So the first wind farm was built in 2003, and pretty soon the state had a long-term vision as to where it wanted to go, and that was to be a clean energy exporter. And luckily, that government won 5 elections in a row, which meant that the policy really could be bedded down. And it was about 2015, the coal-fired power plant in South Australia was shut down. they're using some gas, but since then the amount of gas they've been used has reduced as they've put more and more, invested more and more into solar and wind. South Australia has a large steel plant that's currently working towards conversion to clean steel production, which is fantastic. So the state really is, it's kind of miles ahead of anywhere else, any other large state, at least in Australia. And it's very encouraging to see that even now with a Conservative government in place, they've simply adopted those policies that hasten that energy transition to clean energy, because they can see it's in the state's interest.
That is really good news. So what is the problem with an orderly transition as proposed by the Business Council of Australia and Australia's chief scientist even talks about it?
Yeah, well, I just think the emphasis is wrong, right? Because an orderly transition often means a slow transition economically. And if you have an orderly transition in economic terms, you can create a very disorderly transition in terms of that climate. Right. So we have to actually balance this. We have to listen to the science and say this will take 8% reductions per year and we'll deal with the consequences on the economic side, just as we've done with COVID. You know, the disruption to the Australian economy, by the way, of dealing with COVID as successfully as we have been very significant, but it's a price well worth paying.
Okay, suppose we see a renewable pathway for Australia itself, and it's a country with relatively few people and really rich resources. But what about Australia's customers buying all that coal, like Japan and China and India? Should Australia be tasked with trying to repair some of the damage done by their exports?
Well, I don't know how that would go politically here in Australia. I think it's more realistic to say that Australia needs to hasten its transition so that we can start exporting the products of clean energy, and that will make a difference. But look, having said that, you know, you look at our customers, places like China, South Korea, Japan, they've all got more ambitious climate targets than Australia itself. So we are laggards in this, and we'll be left behind by our customers unless we start moving quickly at the federal level. And can I just explain, Alex, that, you know, in Australia we have states, and those states, almost all of them have really quite advanced targets for reducing CO2 emissions, but we also have a federal government that's a bit more like your Harper government than your Trudeau government of today, that really is steering clear of dealing with the energy issue and is promoting fossil fuels, particularly gas, as the solution. So there's a real tension between lower levels of government in Australia and the federal government.
Sanguine observers, Tim, including many scientists I talk with, admit we failed to stop climate change. Global warming isn't just coming, it's here. So now we must adapt, but can we?
Well, you can adapt to a certain amount. And I guess, you know, when I talk about the creation of this emergency room and making sure we can deal with all the casualties, that is kind of adapting, yeah? But there are limits to adaptation or effective adaptation. So I think we should adapt to what's inevitable, and we have to do that. But we also have to strive to limit the extent of necessary adaptation. In other words, to make sure we're not accelerating this problem. Because there does come a point where the costs become insupportable and the disruption becomes so great that we can't maintain our society as it is today, I think.
You've got a pretty full program for Australia in your book, and I'm wondering, do climate solutions have to be identified pretty well country by country, or could you write the same book for every country?
Look, I think the basic principles are the same for any country, you know, stop the spread, make sure you deal with the casualties, search for a vaccine. They're pretty simple steps and they're effective everywhere. But the actual implementation of each of those steps is probably different for each country because each country has different challenges. I mean, I must say, you know, Canada and Australia are pretty similar, I think, broadly. The challenges are really similar for both of us. Mind you, we've got a problem of heat and aridification, whereas you have a problem of melting permafrost. So there are differences there.
Yes, but we're not doing too well. I think what is sort of toned down investment in our tar sands has just been the low price of oil. If the price of oil goes way up again, those people expect to go back into business. Are there lower prices now for coal? It sounds like coal is becoming not a pariah industry yet, but one that you'll be selling people horses when they're buying cars.
Yeah, there is that, and the coal price is low. But there's also a lot of people just backing away from investment in coal. So just saying this is no longer morally, ethically responsible thing to do, and we're pulling out of it. And look, could I just say, I can hear what you're saying about the tar sands, but, you know, I was in Alberta just soon after the NDP, you know, won government there, and they were pretty active in terms of their climate policy, I must say. And I was impressed at the way they were looking at closing down their coal plants. I'm not sure whether that process has been completed yet. But, you know, the province, I thought at that stage at least, was looking more broadly than just fossil fuels for its future.
There are big wind energy resources there, and they have far more wind machines than British Columbia does. But they now have a conservative government who have reversed many of the things that the NDP had put into place. And I think you've seen that in Australia as well, where a new administration reverses some of the few steps towards progress that were made.
Well, that's true, although here at the state level, we've seen the opposite, so the equivalent of your provincial level. So in South Australia that we just discussed, the Conservative government there has continued with the Labor policy on clean energy because it's so popular. And the same has happened in Tasmania, where a Conservative government has taken over from Labor, and they've continued with clean energy policy. And in fact, they've got a 300% target for clean energy production in that state because they want to export. In New South Wales, we have another Conservative government, and they've just produced the most comprehensive clean energy plan and have taken on, in fact, our local minister in New South Wales has taken on the federal minister just saying, you're wrong about gas. We're going to be going our own way with this. So maybe there's a difference between Canada and Australia there, in that our provincial governments or the equivalent seem to be willing to continue this energy transition.
Well, it will be interesting to see what the new Biden-Harris government can do in the United States after a period of deregulation and a president who said he was going to bring back coal mining. He did not. The big companies went bankrupt anyway. But I think there's some hope for the United States, as divided as they are.
Yes, look, I think so. Again, you look at the state level changes that are happening there, places like California and even Texas with its huge investments in renewables. And I see reason for hope. You know, it'll be great to have a federal administration in place that wants to make a difference here. And look, one of the biggest things on the global stage is the re-engagement with the Paris Agreement. You know, we've got this Glasgow meeting coming up now in October next year, and it really is going to be so critical to our survival in terms of climate, because it's kind of the last chance to do something. And so for the Biden government to be engaged with that is a huge plus, I think, in places like China and other large countries will really listen to what the US is saying and doing in that space.
As we wrap up here, Tim Flannery, is there anything else you would like to say to our international listeners?
I'd just like to say that this is a critical time for us all. You know, this is the moment, these next 3 or 4 or 5, maybe 10 years if we're lucky, when we just have to push through. And we don't want Tim Lenton's warning to go unheeded, that these tipping points are very close. So we need comprehensive policy. I think we all need to get re-engaged with this, and particularly at the political level, and just push for the right decisions to be made.
From Australia, we've been speaking with Dr. Tim Flannery, and his new book is out. It's The Climate Cure, Solving the Climate Emergency in the Era of COVID-19. You can find links to the book and more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you for spending time with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is the climate crisis so severe we need to block out the sun to save ourselves? Putting reflective pollution into the stratosphere could affect weather, essential rains for farms, reduce solar power, and possibly impact health. That never-ending project to cool the Earth would be expensive, too. A scientist and engineer at Harvard has a better solution. The story is brought to us by volunteer radio maker Brent Ragsdale, co-host of Eco Radio in Kansas City, Missouri. Let's listen in.
Welcome to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Tonight's topic is a very interesting project called Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing, which was proposed by my guest, Ye Tao, who's a scientist and engineer with the Rowland Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to the show, Ye.
Thank you, Brent. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about this. So I take it about a year ago, you took off some time from your usual research at the Tao lab at Rowland Institute to look into the problems that we have with the energy imbalance on this planet. So tell me a little bit about how that, what your day job is briefly, and how you got to study something else and make this presentation.
So I was hired by the Rowland Institute at Harvard with the mandate to develop a version of MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, that can deliver much higher resolutions. So we were aiming for an imager that could give you atomic resolution image, and that would be immensely useful for fundamental science investigations in material science for semiconductor industry, and also for the medical industry when you want to find out, say, the structure of the virus, as it's timely right now. So I was used to working on engineering on the ultra-small scale, but it just turns out that regardless like what size range you work at, it's the same physics because it belongs to this the same universe, so the same laws apply. So when I became really aware of the climate emergency, maybe shortly after I got hired back in 2016, it appeared to me that there's a high chance that society will not be the way that has been in the very near future, and the fancy tool for imaging that I was developing may not have the opportunity to even be applied if we don't fix this more urgent issue first. So that's why what prompted me to take a break from my usual line of research and to look at this ultra macro scale planetary scale engineering problem, which incidentally has shared a lot of interesting parallels with my previous work.
Yeah, and what caught my eye about your presentation is that you call it an energy imbalance instead of just climate change. That, I believe, is really true. So you're talking about, we've got this problem where we're overheating, we're not in balance anymore. How bad a problem is that?
Well, we'll get to how bad the problem is, but you're exactly right that it's the atmosphere, and also I'd like to add the ocean, that together provides this sort of buffer that prevents these thermal wild extremes that you see on rocks like the moon. So the heat capacity of the ocean might come back in our discussions later. But the basic problem we're facing now is that, first of all, the climate is still steadily warming because we have roughly like 0.8 watts per meter squared of thermal imbalance, heating imbalance right now. And on top of that, the fact that we are using fossil fuel also means we're creating smog and increasing cloud cover. And that's an additional cooling effect of at least, you know, 1 watt per meter squared. An average is like 1.2. So if we put those two numbers together, 0.8 roughly watt per meter squared that's currently driving the ongoing warming, and the amount of warming that's hidden by the pollution and smog that we put in by burning fossil fuel, 1.2, we're looking at roughly 2 watt per meter squared of unrealized heating power that has not really been realized on Earth. So the consequence of, you know, fully realizing the heating of this thermal imbalance would be on the order of like roughly 2 degrees Celsius. And from ecological studies analyzing individual organisms and the ecosystems, ecologists pretty much concluded that anything above 1.5 or max 2 degrees Celsius, it has a uniformly and universally detrimental impact on ecosystems and crop yields and everything that we depend on. So
you're saying that we've got this imbalance, and it's really based on the amount of carbon that we've already got in the atmosphere. And so how long would it take if we stopped adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere? About how long would it take to reach an equilibrium, a thermal equilibrium on the planet?
Okay, so we certainly do not want the Earth to reach thermal equilibrium at the current loading of excess greenhouse gases. So let's do a thought experiment. Let's stop burning all fossil fuel as of, say, today. Then, as we mentioned, we would be instantaneously subjecting the Earth to a 2 watts per meter squared of heating. And roughly half of that, of the heating potential that's baked in the system, would be realized within, say, 5 to 10 years, or very single-digit decade, very, very soon. which translates to roughly 1 degree Celsius in addition to what we have, bringing the total heating to roughly 2.5 within the next decade, max 2. And the other half would be a much slower process. That's because Earth has pretty deep oceans, and the top mixed layer is what responds very quickly in the, you know, the 50% the first decade or two. But the much deeper layers, heat takes a long time to reach them, and they sort of play a buffering effect. So that's why the second half, second degree, from the 2.5 to 3.5 degree, that would take on the order of centuries. So from engineering point of view, we really need to really target the fast time response in the next decade or two, which is roughly 1 degree Celsius plus minus a little bit of certain heating in the case of instantaneously stopping fossil fuel and losing anthropogenic aerosol cooling effect.
So I kind of interrupted you before when you were talking about the effects, the studies that look at crop yields and things like that at an increase of 2 degrees Celsius as a planetary average increase. What would happen if we did let this go without either bringing the carbon concentration down or figuring out a way to reflect some of this heat back off the planet?
So the agricultural studies published in the past decade or so agree that we're looking at a decrease in crop yield from now onwards in the next 50 years, let's say. The predictions vary, but they fall in the range of, say, 5 to 60% reduction in agricultural yield on current trajectory. And that's assuming some of the representative emission pathways, which are hypothetical future scenarios made by the IPCC. So the hypothetical case I was talking about of this 1 degree heating, I don't think has been analyzed, but the 1 degree heating that we talked about is faster than the IPCC pathways, which do not assume complete removal of all fossil fuel burning technologies. Yeah, but we're looking, certainly looking at on the order of tens of percent, potentially the majority of a crop being lost.
Hmm. So you're essentially a scientist and an engineer, but a lot of what you do is solving engineering type problems, but on the nanoscale. But you've proposed this solution to this energy imbalance that you call MEER, which is Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing. Explain that to us.
So as we mentioned, instead of trying to promote more IR radiation or heat escaping the Earth's atmosphere, we can stop further accumulation of excess water or excess heat in this bathtub by turning off or turning down the faucet. So the way to do that for the Earth's thermal system is to have increased the reflectivity of the Earth as a whole. Many features and structures on Earth have different levels of reflectivity toward shortwave radiation, like glaciers is brighter than seawater and they absorb less heat, and you wear white when you don't want to get too hot in the sun. So it's the same principle. Traditionally, people have somehow focused on increasing this reflectivity above ground, either in the sky via seeding clouds or even much higher in the stratosphere by mimicking volcanic eruptions. Or there are also ideas of putting solar sail-based mirrors into space to intercept a part of that radiation. I think it's probably partly inspired by the people coming up with these ideas who are themselves scientists, engineers working on systems occurring at those levels, aerospace engineers. Me, myself, I'm a nanoscience, a nanotechnology guy, so I'm very much grounded in the very basics and just things to make, you know, your cell phones, computer chips, things the way you deploy on ground. So I guess it's natural for our project to come to the realization that it's the cheapest and the safest to deploy albedo modification on the ground rather than in the form of yet aerosol particles with yet unknown consequences for the atmospheric chemistry and also ecosystems. Something like a piece of glass has been with us for thousands of years, and they're benign objects, and we know how robust they are and how durable they are. So just use well-designed glass mirrors on the ground, we believe, is the cheapest and safest, and also gives us also opportunity to use them for other purposes rather than just to block out sunlight.
So part of engineering and problem solving is doing it cost-effectively and utilizing the resource within the resource constraints that we have. So the solution that you're putting forward is really based on the fact that we have to do something really quickly and really large on a global scale, and what resources do we have available. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we first, well, when you're confronted with an engineering problem, you have to really understand the constraints and what's the design target. So managing or mitigating climate change is a planetary scale problem, and only material that are abundant on the planetary scale can even be considered as starting material for your solution. So looking at Earth, we have silicon, oxygen, and aluminum as basically the top most abundant elements. That's why that helped guide us into thinking that we should be utilizing these elements as the building blocks for both the infrastructure and also for the functional device layers. So optical glass is basically silicon dioxide, and that's probably one of the cheapest materials, dirt. It's your sand. So if you want to make something cheap, then make it from dirt. So it's dirt cheap.
Okay, well, that's probably a good place for us to take our first break. We'll be back to talk more about these ideas of using mirrors to address Earth's energy imbalance.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock as we listen to Harvard scientist Ye Tao from the Rowland Institute on his project to cool the Earth with mirrors built into everything. It's called Mirror Reflection, M-E-E-R Reflection. Here's producer and host Brent Ragsdale from KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome back to EcoRadio KC. My guest is Dr. Ye Tao of Harvard's Rowland Institute, and we're discussing an engineering solution he's put forward to address climate change called mirror reflection. So, Dr. Tao, you're telling us that we've got a lot of abundant resources like silica to make glass. You hear a lot about a shortage of sand, but I believe that's the sand that has rough edges so that it's useful for concrete. But I think maybe there's a lot more sand that's in deserts and maybe it's available for use in making glass. Is that correct?
I think the sand shortage is due to the construction sector. So you need a certain grain size for the sand. And for our applications, what we want to do is to melt it down to block so we can use sand and rocks and minerals. So we are not really limited by the feature in which the natural feature in which the sand or the material presents itself.
Okay. So your idea to cool the Earth is to reflect a portion of the incoming radiation back into space using these mirrors. And so the mirrors would sit just flat on the surface of the Earth or on the ocean. Is that right?
So that's a very interesting question. So from just analyzing the efficiency of the mirrors' point of view, it's easiest to just assume that they're flat because there's data of solar radiation, what's called horizontal solar irradiance, that measures how much light that arrives at a piece of land or surface that's horizontal to the local topography. Actually, there is a room to improve their efficiency for locations that are, say, in northern or very much southern latitude, where, say, the solar angle is not really, you know, passed by the zenith every day, but is at some low angle above the horizon. If we tilt the mirror installations towards the, you know, average direction of the sun, then we get more bang for the buck. And we have a team member doing that analysis to figure out what's the optimal orientation for the mirrors for each location on Earth. And there's some heterogeneity as a result of not only the latitude, but also local cloud cover and other factors, and local heterogeneity in the atmospheric gas concentrations.
So speaking of bang for the buck, I've heard you say that it makes more sense to deploy the mirrors where normally there would be a lot of absorption. So the ocean would be kind of ideal if you could go from absorbing all of that solar heat to reflecting most of it back. That would be the best. But how much of the Earth do we really need to do? How much of the Earth needs to be covered by mirrors to really make a difference?
So let's first define what you mean by difference. Let's define difference as first, in the first case, as equivalent to stopping all fossil fuel emissions. Then obviously, if we're still burning fossil fuel at the current rate, but we're just building mirrors at the same time to cancel the negative heating effect of such emissions, then we need to build an area the size of Kansas every year for that to, you know, to cancel out contemporary emissions. Another case is, let's say we want to stop climate change instantaneously at the 2020 level that it has already occurred up to now, but we don't want it to go any worse. Then we need to build the size of Peru, and
wow,
then thereafter cancel out whatever excess emission we have by building something, you know, probably smaller than Kansas at that point. So it's for sure a gigantic engineering challenge. That's why at the Mere Reflection, we are thinking holistically of how to have a multi-step, a coherent framework to first get the thermal threat under control, and then use the versatility of mirrors, which are nothing but light handling devices that allow us to satisfy a range of energy needs for this civilization, thus gradually promoting synergistically, promoting a moving away from fossil fuels.
So explain that. You can also use mirrors for concentrating the light and getting power. How does that work?
So this technology has been around for several decades. So there are many ways to capture the sun's energy. Either you convert photons directly to excitons in silicon photovoltaics and extract that out as a electric current voltage, or we can just convert the light to heat first and use heat to run conventional steam turbines. And it turns out this running steam turbines from the heat is actually more efficient than photovoltaics. The requirement is that you have to build these larger power plants to make that happen. So it's a utility scale process rather than photovoltaics, which can be installed in people's homes. But from a energy cost and environmental cost perspective, the route by going by steam, by through heat, is actually more environmental. It's roughly 40% more environmental measured in terms of equivalent CO2 emissions compared to solar photovoltaics. The unfortunate thing is the technology didn't have a head start, as in the case of photovoltaics. But if we have a government that's responsible for the ecology and future of the world, then they would be exclusively promoting the more environmentally friendly version, which is solar thermal power.
Yeah. I can see a couple of other advantages too. So I understand that these concentrator solar plants that are making heat, then that acts kind of like a battery as well, that you can have a molten salt or something that can hold heat quite efficiently from the daytime to the nighttime and level out the power that you can generate. So that would be one thing.
That's exactly correct. So thermal storage is scalable rather than, you know, compared to, say, batteries. Battery technology like lithium, et cetera, they're simply not going to scale because of the limitation in the resource and abundance in the Earth's crust. So thermal storage will play a bigger and bigger role as we move towards renewables. And concentrating solar thermal is ideally suited for smoothing out those intermittency problems.
And you can also, I think, make this a factory that's sort of self-replicating for the mirrors, could you not? Where you're using the heat from the sun from a bunch of mirrors to melt the sand and float more glass. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct in principle. So one of the earlier thoughts that really prompted me to look into this is, first of all, we're confronting a exponentially worsening problem. You know, the heat at which, the rate at which the Earth is accumulating heat and with feedback mechanisms that's just going to accelerate this heating. Then we probably need some sort of medicine or a scheme that can self-replicate, at least on the energy demand point of view. So one can build these solar thermal furnaces, indeed, to melt down sand and the ingredients to make glass to power the mirror manufacturing. So it's a scheme that could be, to a certain extent, self-replicating.
Okay.
But the really exciting point I want to mention is that our analysis shows glass is just such an easy-to-make material, and it has such a low embodied energy content that even if it were to use fossil fuel energy, it's still going to pay back by a ratio of at least 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 in the equivalent CO2 heating that's used to make it.
And that kind of fits in your scheme, too. Once you internalize the idea that we can't stop burning fossil fuels cold turkey, because then we're going to get this 1 degree Celsius global average temperature rise. So maybe we wean ourselves off the fossil fuels, add more electricity that's generated through concentrator solar voltaic or solar thermal. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I don't think it has been fruitful to go head-to-head and just really antagonize the public or a segment of the public with certain industries. It hasn't really worked. I think that's the data in the past decades. So in the remaining basically the last decade that we have left for any action, it would be unwise to continue the path that has been historically problematic and unfruitful. So let's think of a way around, work around, that actually could leverage also support from this industry. And of course, with the understanding that your industry is dying no matter what, because there is a limited reserve of fossil fuels. But here is a scheme that would enable some usage of the industry and help you transition to a renewable form as well. So eventually we'll have to synthesize our own fuels, our own fine chemicals from CO2. There's no question about that. So if, say, fossil fuel industry could be mobilized to assist in that process and also transition, remake themselves, I think that would be what I see as the only viable way forward from a political and economics perspective.
And from just a control standpoint, it seems like a big concentrator plant or a multitude of large concentrator plants then could also manage the amount of power generation versus what the demands are. And then any time that we don't need power, those mirrors could be steered to optimize the reflection of that heat energy that's coming to the planet back out into space. Whereas if we do a multitude of mirrors like we do on rooftop solar, on residential and small businesses, those are going to be basically mounted. They're going to be fixed. They're not going to adjust the angle, track the sun. They're not going to be able to shut them on and off dynamically. So there's a lot of reasons why you'd want to do the big scale. Is that right?
I think that's partly correct. So it's important to understand that the scale of mirror needed to achieve planetary cooling is much larger than what's needed to power the whole world. So say the excess heat that you captured instead of rejecting from the power generation plant, it's very negligible, very small compared to the static mirrors that are performing the main purpose of heat regulation, heat rejection.
I see. So if we create this many mirrors, and then 100 years from now, if it takes us that long to get the concentration of greenhouse gases back down to a level that we don't need the mirrors, then at least they're fairly recyclable. They're only glass with a little layer of aluminum on them. And so it's not like they've polluted your planet too much. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So one feature that's really nice about these mirrors is that they're pretty much, pure silicon. They would be glass, silicon dioxide with some ions to make them soften better, so flow better as glass. And the amount of aluminum or whatever other reflector material we add are on the tens of nanometer thickness range, which is completely negligible compared to a structure that's on the order of millimeter to maybe up to a centimeter in thickness. So you can just basically take the whole thing and melt it down, and it will have the same quality glass melt as you started. So it's essentially 100% recyclable. And the engineering challenge, and what's really excites myself intellectually and as an engineer, is to design a product which would be highly stable to weathering, such that it should last for decades, hopefully century timescale, without really the need to be regenerated. But of course, once, as Brent mentioned, if we succeeded in this mere facilitated transition to renewable energy or renewable carbon neutral liquid fuel economy, then we wouldn't need to build any more mirrors. And as atmospheric greenhouse gases naturally decay through natural processes like forest regrowth, we will need less and less mirrors, and we actually have to slowly take them down, decommission them, so we keep thermal balance, because otherwise we would be like in your bathtub losing water. We don't want to lose all the water. Right?
Yeah, and it wouldn't be as compelling of a sell to people once the general public realizes we need to do this if they thought we were going to be turning the earth into a disco ball forever. I think that if we sell it as this is what needs to be done, but we're transitioning towards being in balance a more natural way, like you say, through regenerative agriculture that builds the soil carbon, reforestation where that's appropriate, wilding prairies where that's appropriate. Yeah. Okay, well, you've made a pretty compelling case that our biggest problem is this temperature imbalance and that we're going to overheat. What other problems do we have? What's our second biggest problem?
So I'm an engineering scientist, so I won't get into how human societies are currently organized. That's in my mind the cause, but that's not my mandate to solve. So on the scientific and engineering side, the second problem after we will have addressed thermal overheating would be ocean acidification. because right now, if we continue to burn coal for the next decades, we could destabilize the pH for many parts of the ocean, and that could have negative consequences for marine organisms. So in Project Mirror Reflection, we actually have realized that we can tackle ocean acidification problem together with this CO2 concentration in atmosphere. So actually leveraging nature, leveraging the ocean as part of the solution. So conventional direct air capture methods require that we use a gigantic fence and pass the atmosphere through these fans with a sorbent to filter out the minute quantities of the CO2 gas that's currently in the atmosphere. That's a very labor-intensive process from the point of view of the machines. It's like you're paid to sit and to watch grains of sand go by, and you have to pick out the dark sand grains. That's a very energy-intensive process. What the ocean has done for us is that by virtue of its large area, it has allowed CO2 to be absorbed and dissolved into the ocean, into carbonic acid, and it's at some buffered state. And we all have learned, hopefully in high school chemistry, that acid-base reaction is the fastest and the most selective and the easiest reaction that you can demonstrate. So now CO2 is already captured basically in the ocean as an acid. If we just add a little bit of base baking soda or something, it would just get neutralized. So it's a very simple way to capture because the difficult part of sifting it from the air has been done for us by the gigantic surface area of the ocean. So we then realized that if we use a very benign base, basically calcium oxide or calcium hydroxide, we can neutralize this carbonic acid and also fertilize or promote the growth of calcifying organisms that include shellfish, oysters, clams, and a bunch of other goodies that I enjoy eating myself. So I thought to myself, let's do a thought experiment. Let's say we convinced everybody, instead of going vegan, let's become seafood eaters and let's focus on scallops and clams and shellfish, other mussels. And what can we do with the shell that comes out from such a diet? So it turns out that if we were to feed everybody on Earth, the seafood diet consisted of these marine bivalves, we have enough shell to produce enough calcium oxide through solar thermal decomposition to neutralize one half of the current CO2 emissions. So by this sort of a diet change, we can basically collude with nature, have the sea capture concentrated CO2, and have these critters, organisms, do the fixation for us in the form of shell. And then during, in your recycling, we would just add a bin dedicated to shells, and then the truck would carry it to your local solar thermal lime production facility, and the sunlight will turn that into calcium oxide. And of course, CO2 will evolve in the process, but then the stream of CO2 that comes out will be very pure. And that's amenable then to be used as feedstock to make liquid fuel using electricity. Hopefully, by that time, solar thermally generated electricity. And this
could you do that with limestone as well? Or would it be much easier with oyster shell?
Oyster shell is much easier because it's already basically crushed up, right? When you eat it, or when the factory that processes these clams or mussels, it's very thin. So heat conduction and the exposure and decomposition is very fast. In the case of if you want to use a quarried limestone to make lime, you have to use gigantic machinery to crush it up, and that's an extra step. And if it's already part of the daily recycling and the waste management process, it doesn't really incur that much extra investment.
Yeah.
So that's an additional saving. So that's why I think it's good to put different solutions together in an organic and way.
Well, it seems like most people's reaction to this mirror reflection idea is kind of, their knee-jerk reaction is, isn't that the same kind of thinking, technology thinking that got us in this problem in the first place? I don't see it that way. I think that technology is what's grown the human population to 7 billion. If we wouldn't have figured out how to get nitrogen fertilizer out of fossil fuels, we wouldn't have as many people as we have now. If we didn't have as many people, we wouldn't have as many wastes and the problems. But what's your reply to that kind of a objection?
I think it's natural to associate this idea, you know, to high technology. Well, maybe because it's coming out from an elite school, and we don't have a good reputation about being inclusive and also thinking really sustainably. But I think what really distinguishes this concept is that we are really aiming to make the most high-quality mirrors that you can make. It's a bit like going back in ages where we really value the craftsmanship and high-quality stuff that's, you know, usable and passed down over generations, rather than contemporary culture of consumerism and everything is designed to have a date of expiration and failure so that you have to, you're obliged to go buy stuff. I think on the cultural front, we also want to promote ideas that you really want to make things that are stable, durable, high quality. And we really want to transition, help transition the economy also to a more locally based economy. So in the shell degradation and calcium oxide production process, so we're proposing, instead of just throwing the calcium oxide directly into the ocean to neutralize the acid and promote shellfish growth, we first hydrolyze it by adding water to make it calcium hydroxide. The process, if you have made concrete, I think traditionally you will know it releases heat. So calculations show that if we just design a sort of heat generation circulation system to send that heat to people's home, we can provide roughly 95% of the world's space heating needs from that reaction alone. And these heat distribution systems, they work for a few square miles, not over, you know, hundreds of miles. So
it would be like coastal district heating kind of thing. So instead of having natural gas boilers and steam and hot water going through pipes to heat the town, it would be seawater coming in, getting a little bit neutralized, being exothermic, creating the heat that will warm the houses, and then going back into the ocean, something like that.
Well, I guess in practice, you would be like, you can use seawater as the heat carrying agent, but instead of burning fossil fuel to heat this water through pipes, you'd be just embedding the pipes in this calcium oxide as it becomes calcium hydroxide and extract this heat. So the system doesn't need to be really modified that much. It's actually a simplified system. The hot water distribution network or steam can stay the same. It's just in the heat exchanger. Rather than having boilers, you have this a gigantic container that performs this hydration reaction.
Yeah, I see. Before we go, Yay, tell us where people could get more information about this.
You can just go to our website. It's www.mirreflection.com. Mirrorreflection.com.
Mirrorreflection. Okay, we'll be back.
That was a guest session with Brent Ragsdale, co-host of Eco Radio KC from KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Learn more in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Do you have a good idea for Radio EcoShock? Would you like to produce a segment for an international audience? Be sure to write me first. My email address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We shall never surrender.